Compose the mind on the breath. Let's see that as an object of, well, you can immediately, just one inhalation, one exhalation, just that much alone is at least composing the mind rather than just letting it wander about. Even if that's all you do, eventually you can just develop just this ability to completely concentrate the mind on one inhalation, one exhalation. So it's a matter of doing it, of practicing, using that as a, as your, what you turn to, what you use as your gammatthana. In reflection, we reflect using our reflective ability, developing this. Now this very much needs to be developed in human beings because it's not highly developed yet in the human mind. Our education, European education, tends to condition us into thinking in certain intellectual patterns, according to logic and reason, ideas. But it's not, we don't have a reflective education. We don't reflect on life or existence. We more or less take positions on it and then deduct from the position we're in and make all kinds of assumptions about life from already a defined position. Other than from, say, a theistic religious position, the God is our creator, or from an atheistic, that there isn't any God, or from just a materialistic, humanistic position, all there is humanity, or maybe in some people's lives there's nothing that even that clear. there's just a fuzziness, just going through the motions of getting up in the morning and eating and going to bed at night, or seeking pleasure. Reflection is making life a fully conscious experience. It allows us to see life in full consciousness. We're not lying about it, we're not making assumptions about it, we're not trying to hide away from it, we're not judging it, condemning it, criticizing it, or exaggerating or exalting it. Reflection is just the ability to bring into consciousness at this time the way it is. So that at this time and at this place, the time is now, the place is here. That's the obvious one, isn't it? We're here, Amaravati. This is the Easter Sunday, according to the Christian calendar. Sunday morning. Yesterday, what is yesterday now? And a practical, as it actually is, yesterday, we're sitting here at this time and in this place. Yesterday is a memory, isn't it? You remember yesterday. You think, well, yesterday has passed. It's no more. That's the assumption we make, isn't it, that yesterday has passed. But yesterday is a memory. It always has been. All the yesterdays of our lives are memories of that come up in the present moment. Think of what you did yesterday, something you remember of what happened to you yesterday. That's what a memory is. So a memory arises in the mind in the present moment. Where if we don't affirm this and fully recognize this, then we tend to hold on to the things of yesterday as having more reality to us. They become either they dismissed, rejected, or they're exaggerated, held on to. But in reflection, what I'm doing now is just pointing out to the way it actually is, without taking it personally or making anything or complicating it in any way. Even if the memory of yesterday is a pleasant one, it's the happiest memory of your life, or it's a terrible memory, we're not pointing to the quality of it, whether it's beautiful or ugly, but the fact that it is a memory. It arises and ceases in the mind at this moment. Tomorrow is what? While we're sitting here at this time and in this place, what is tomorrow? It's as far as in a practical way as it really is. Tomorrow is what we don't know, isn't it? We don't know tomorrow. It hasn't happened yet, so we can't remember it. We can't remember tomorrow. So that tomorrow is what we don't know. So this is another way of beginning to realize your own mind, that tomorrow is all the unknown things. So tomorrow has the appearance of having infinite potential for all forms of happiness or misery, or anything in between. And that tomorrow is, it was hope, we have hope. If we're optimistic, we hope that tomorrow everything is just going to be wonderful. Or we dread that tomorrow everything is just going to be horrible. We wait for tomorrow, we expect. I'm expecting something to happen to me tomorrow. I'm hoping everything will be all right. I'm afraid that everything will be all wrong. I worry about tomorrow because there's so many possibilities for misery and failure and sickness and separation and depression. And so, because it's unknown, isn't it? Will the Americans attack the Soviet Union? Will Mr. Gaddafi blow up the Mediterranean? What will happen to Britain in the future? Pollution on the planet and all kinds of gloomy predictions of the future. There's the Armageddon school and the doomsday gloom and doom, that God's taking revenge on us for being so hedonistic and materialistic after all these years. God's just about had enough and going to slam us. There's that one. Or there's the Golden Age prophecies. The Aquarian Age, where everything is just, where we're going to just have so much happiness. And society is going to develop into a very more advanced state, the Golden Age of Aquarius. But what we can know at this time and in this place is that we don't know. Now that's knowing. That's direct knowing. even if some prophet walked into the room right now, some clairvoyant, highly gifted seer into the future, and he came in and he sat down and said, in the next few years, the Golden Age will develop and we'll all be very, very happy. It might make you feel good right now, thinking, oh, that's really nice to hear. What I'd like to hear. But what we can know through reflection is that we don't know, really, that because it hasn't happened yet. We can believe in it, Or we can disbelieve it, but with the being fully conscious of the way the mind is at this time, fully conscious of the fact that we don't know, because the future is the unknown. So now, at this time, and at this place, at this moment, in consciousness, there is this knowing. It's not knowing about the future, anything in particular, or having all kinds of views and opinions of from the past experiences of life, or knowing all about history, anthropology, biology, zoology, botany, chemistry, physics, the whole gamut of knowledge. It's not that knowing. You can be illiterate. In fact, you don't even, to do this kind of practice, you don't even have to know how to read and write. But to find an illiterate person these days is, in this country, is a rare thing, isn't it? But the literate ones are much more in supply. But this kind of knowledge is knowledge of the way things are, which means that we reflect, we open the mind to the obvious, the time. What is the time now then? Time, as far as we think it's 14 minutes to 6 o'clock in the morning, British summer time. That's the time, that's the perception of time we have, say, at this moment. But actually, the time is now, isn't it? It's now. And the place, I think the place is what? Well, it's we're in England. This is Hertfordshire. This is Amaravati Buddhist Center. This is a retreat center. This is the meditation hall. We've got it down to that, to the meditation hall, to the place we're sitting in, this place here. So that the place is here. The time is now. And this is when we reflect in this way, we're no longer attaching to even the perceptions that we have of being in England, being at a Buddhist center, being in any designated place according to a name or convention, but establishing in consciousness the most obvious. It's so obvious we oftentimes think it's not worth even recognizing. But what this does, if you reflect in this way, you begin to become more and more aware of the way life actually is for us, and not so caught up in the way it seems, the way we're conditioned to look at it and to experience life according to our desires and fears, loves and hates, prejudices and viewpoints. We begin to see those as they're reflected in the actual truth of the way it is. So then the time is now, the place is here, and there's this being here, this body, sitting here, and it's a body, a human body. And it's conscious. It has consciousness. The fact that we can know like this means that there's consciousness. So we recall that there's this human body and that there's consciousness. Nama-rupa in Pali. Nama-rupa. Now consciousness is what? The fact that we can know things, isn't it? There's eye consciousness. We have eyes to see objects, so that there's There's this, there's consciousness through the organ of the eye, chakkhu vijnana consciousness. There's consciousness through the ear, the sota vijnana consciousness. We can hear, we know sounds. We can hear sound. Consciousness through the nose, odors, through the tongue, flavors, through the body, heat and cold, pleasure and pain. Then there's the mano-vijnana consciousness of the brain, the mind, ability to receive all these other things, to give them names, to call them things, to think and relate one thing with another, to create. We can create all kinds of ideas and images with mano-vijnana consciousness. You can create a whole fantasy world, can't you? If you were blind, your ears were plugged up, your nose lost your sense of smell, your tongue was cut out, and you had paralysis on your body, you could still live in a fantasy world. You could create all kinds of fantasies. Anything, isn't it? More, some people are very imaginative. They have fantastic imagery in the mind. But there's also the knowing. There's the knowing that is transcending all of that, the ability to create and fantasize and think and perceive through the senses. And this is what we're pointing to in the reflection, what we're actually using, this ability, this transcendent knowing. Because this transcendent knowing knows that all these other consciousnesses, the knowing that the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, the conditions of mind are impermanent. They arise and they cease in the mind. There's knowing when they're present and when they're not present. So that this is what we call the insight knowledge, or the knowing where to reach this knowing, we have to reflect on the way things are. If we don't reflect and really see things as they are, we tend to believe in the appearance of things. That's the easiest thing for us to do. If we don't put any effort into penetrating into the nature of things, the easiest thing, most convenient habit of mind is to believe in the appearance. Just to believe in our thoughts and views and opinions and the way we perceive as being reality. So reflection, this is developing this ability, this very unused ability to be the knowing rather than to be a person. Because in this knowing, when there's knowing, it's not personal anymore. You're transcending personal qualities. You're transcending your personality, transcending being a man or woman, transcending all the whatever nationality you are, transcending all the memories of the past. Because you're seeing these things as conditions that arise and cease in the mind. They're no longer attached to and identified with as personal things, and then operating in life as if these were really oneself, because they appear to be oneself. It's the easiest thing to do, is to believe that all these things are oneself. the morning chanting, the beginning, see, during this retreat, the morning chanting is the beginning. We note beginnings, like the beginning of the inhalation, beginning of the exhalation. Because this is the way it is. This is the beginning of our day, the beginning of the day. Beginning again. Yesterday is a memory. Tomorrow is the unknown. Now, say, is the knowing. This is the beginning. So we recollect, we compose ourselves at the beginning. Because how we start the day, how we begin the day, has its effect on how we live our life during this day. If we begin in a heedless, clumsy way, then the day tends to follow in that pattern. When we begin in a more mindful, more skillful way, then that helps us to live life during the day in a more mindful, more skillful way. So at the beginning of a day, we say at this time and at this place, we meet in this hall. We do this chanting. Now this chanting is merely, is a traditional Theravadan custom from Theravada Buddhism, Pali Buddhism from Southeast Asia, from Sri Lanka, so that it's a tradition that's been carried on from the ancient time. In the time of Buddha, is something that goes through the past from a time that we can't remember at all, 2,500 years ago, to yesterday, which we can remember, and to the present moment now. So that there's this continuity from the ancient time, what we consider ancient time, to modern time. It's like something that contains and holds the teaching. The teachings would be blown away if they didn't have any container, any conventional form that would hold that they could be contained within and passed on from one generation to the next. Like there have been many wise sages, seers, enlightened beings who we've never known and will never know because they've never, their teachings, once they die or disappear, there's nothing left to carry on their teaching. Their teaching is when they've gone, then of course there's nothing to pass it on to the next person. Now Gautama the Buddha was obviously a very wise teacher because his teaching has managed somehow or other to survive for 2,529 years. That's quite an impressive thing, really, when you think of it, that a teaching can survive and still be as pure, completely as pure as it was at the time that he taught it. What I'm teaching now is not any corrupted, elaborated form of Buddhist teaching. It's the pure teaching, the very essence, the Four Noble Truths, the important teaching. So it hasn't been corrupted or changed in any way at all. Even though traditional Buddhism has become much more elaborate and many things have been added to it, somehow it's never, the elaboration, say, of Theravada Buddhism has never hidden the actual essence of the teaching of the Buddha. Even though it has become quite ornate and elaborate in Theravada and Buddhist countries, the pure teaching is still there. It's not hidden, it's not smothered in the filigree and elaboration that have followed in 2,500 years. So we come, we the monastic life, we follow this tradition because it is our a kind of gift to us in which we can pass, which we can use, and then pass it on to the next generation, so that it is something that will be passed on, not just die with this little group of monks here. When I pass on, or Venerable Amaro, he's still very young yet, but he'll die someday too. When he and I are dead and nothing left, or this is something that is, it will be passed on from one generation to another. Well, it stands a much better chance of it happening through some kind of agreed convention and tradition than just through the whims and opinions and views of various charismatic individual monks or gurus. The reflections, as I say, lighting the candles, incense, flowers, these are the traditional offerings that people make at a Buddhist shrine, because they're objects that are easy to get. Poor people can make offerings to the shrine as well as the wealthy. In Buddhist countries, these are not difficult things to get, to buy. They're not expensive. Flowers, what? The most beautiful thing you can offer, aren't they? Flowers are the earthly perfection of color and form, shape. Flowers, they grow, they're part of nature. They're not made by us. They're real flowers. And they're very beautiful. They're colors, they're shapes. So that we offer something that is truly beautiful to the shrine. Candles represent light, isn't it? You have offer candles so that you can have light, so you can sustain light for a while. If you have candles, you can light the candle, and then the light is sustained for the length of time that the candle is there. So that this is also another offering of light, and then incense, the fragrance of incense, kind of going through everything, isn't it? The fragrance penetrates through the whole room, giving a good, a pleasant aroma. With light and with then visual beauty of the flowers, these are beautiful offerings to give at a shrine. Now, making these offerings also is something that is very pleasing to the one who's making the offerings. Makes us feel good when we do things like that. When we come in and we make an offering, we bow to the shrine. Now, bowing is also a beautiful gesture that we make with the body, so that we don't just come in and flop down on the sitting mat, go into samadhi posture, and just kind of crash into the room, crash down on your sitting mat. Going, some people do that, and if going, they sit down like this. They don't have any. They don't direct their attention. They don't have any form, graceful form, for their bodies. They tend to just do what is the easiest thing to do. I remember in Thailand, so many Westerners just didn't want to be bothered with the Thai customs. You don't have to bow, it's not important. You don't have to chant. You don't have to do those things, are totally unimportant. We don't have to do those things. I just want to practice samadhi. They like that. This part, sometimes. But then one of the unbeautiful things is just the human body that has not developed any grace to it, any kind of mindful movements, isn't it? Where we just kind of flop about. And I was in Australia recently. And Australia is a country that doesn't have any, it's a country where people just do what they feel like doing. There's no kind of culture to contain their movements or their speech, so that everything is quite coarse. People don't have any real grace to their lives. It's convenient, pleasant country, but there's nothing to train oneself with in moving, in acting, in speaking, in beautiful ways. So that when you go to Australia, if you're used to, say, a much more kind of graceful way of living, mindful way of living, you see some things that are really quite ugly to see. And people just kind of lying about in the shrine room, and nobody for having any sense for, say, the sacred or how to conduct one's self in a situation, just more or less do as you want, hanging loose, modern term. In the religious life, spiritual life, we try to develop a form in which we can come together and a group of people, group of individual human beings, conduct themselves in a way that is in harmony. They're together. They're doing the same thing. They're making the offering. It's a corporate action, a corporate movement, where we're not kind of going against each other, rubbing against each other, or conflicting in any way. We can actually learn how a ceremony is something that we do together for a good purpose, for something that we respect, something that we love, making offerings, paying respect. So that these are the value of a ceremony is the fact that it includes everyone. It's not just the priest or the one who's just a few, the monks or the nuns, but it can include everyone in this corporate action, corporate offering. And I think ceremony is now not understood by most people in the West. We tend to be so individualistic, so caught up with doing things as an individual, separate creature, that we've lost that appreciation for doing something as a group, except maybe some kind of mob violence, football, like British football, that people do things in a group there, don't they? Tear down the, destroy the football stadium, or we can do things kind of through mob violence, where everybody gets carried away with a low kind of brutal emotion. But say ceremony is not on that level. It's higher up. It's a an offering from love, from respect, devotion. The bowing of the human body is a gesture, say if developed, where the head, we take the top part of our body, that which we identify with the most, we identify with our faces, and we bow. So the head goes to the floor, goes low rather than is held up high. And that is a beautiful gesture of surrender, of humility. Arrogance is always has the appearance of holding your head high and saying, I'm better than everyone else. I won't bow to anyone. And so that the arrogant position is always this very aggressive looking creature that says, I'm better than everyone. I wouldn't bow to golden images and foolish things like that. So arrogance is always has that. I think Mussolini was the kind of quintessential arrogant figure of the age, wasn't he? He always had this kind of incredible stance, in like this. You can't imagine Mussolini coming into this room and bowing. <can you? laughs> Of course, we can be arrogant bowers. Say, like Uriah Heep, I'm more humble than you are. Then reflecting on the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, the Buddha. Now this, for many of you, probably is just an exotic word. It might not mean that much to many of you. So it's a word to reflect on. The Buddha image on the shrine is a symbol. The Buddhist art, it's in the Buddhism has developed this art form. I don't think you find it rarely in any other the Buddha image or the human being, the enlightened human being is symbolized. European art, Christian art, tends to always emphasize the passions of the human being. You go into Catholic cathedrals, you find all the imagery very passionate. Great sorrow or ecstasy or agony. I remember going into the cathedral in Malaga in Spain, Renaissance cathedral, and every niche in the whole place was filled with sorrowful figures. Everyone. Every niche, there were so many of them too, was all about sorrow and pain and agony. I really found it quite difficult to understand it, because the cathedral itself was very beautiful. Now the representation of the human form in the state as enlightened rather than in passionate caught up in the passions of greed, hatred, and delusion. So that the Buddha image is that. That's why it's quite stylized, why you can stylize them, because it is a symbol. It's not trying to be accurate representation, a kind of photographic likeness of an enlightened human being, but it's a symbol of humanity, of a human being who is enlightened. So the enlightened human being is what? You see, from this image here, that there's a alertness in the face. There's serenity. The face itself is serene. It's not laughing. It's not in ecstasy. It's not in a trance. It's not closing its eyes. It's not like the monkey covering its eyes. The hands are here. The posture is erect. And there's this clarity, this awakened serenity. So that is a very skillful kind of symbol, actually, because it helps to remind us that this is possible for a human being. It's not about some god who lived 2,500 years ago. That's not what it's for, that we're worshipping some kind of deity who was enlightened and looked like that and had flame coming out of his head, top of his head. That's not. That's a symbolic of the human being enlightened. So Buddha means that, the enlightened one, the one who knows. The one who knows the way things are, the truth. It's not a personal knowing. It's not my knowing. It's not a monk or a nun or a lay person, man or woman. It's knowing. That is when we are awake and alert. That's where we are. We're that way. We're knowing, which is, say, the true refuge in Buddha. In the knowing. So Buddha can be personified. That's why you can make Buddha rupas, because you can personify Buddha. It's the wisdom of a human being, of an awakened human being, that is transcendent. It's not a human being per se, but it's within the human form. It manifests through the human form. Then the Dhamma, we take refuge in the Dhamma. The Dhamma is, we use words like santitiko, akaliko, ehipasko, panayiko, bhajitang, vaitidapo, vinyuhi. Now, Dhamma is a most marvelous word that is very difficult to put into English, because there's not really an English equivalent to it. There's not the English thought cannot encompass the true meaning of Dhamma. And so Dhamma is really means that which supports everything, the truth, that which holds everything together, that which interpenetrates and supports and holds together. We can call it the ultimate truth. But then it becomes more kind of abstracted, doesn't it? Like truth for us tends to almost be kind of an abstraction in the mind, ultimate truth. So with Dhamma, say we take refuge in Dhamma, the truth of the way it is, so that we're opening to truth or to the way it is. We're not trying to open to truth as if it was some abstracted kind of thing that it will come floating in to us if we call on it and it suddenly appears. But truth is to be seen here and now. And so opening to truth is a matter of being alert and awake now. It's not that there is any lack of it at this moment. It means that we may not be open to it at this moment, is the problem. So that the Dhamma is here and now Dhamma, santitiko akaliko. It's not a matter of time, that the truth appears at a certain time. and other times it doesn't. It's akaliko. Ehipasiko is to, it's something, it's, we have to open to it, turn to it, accept it, embrace it, be with it. It has this kind of imminence. It's imminent to us. It's not something far away. Upanayika dhamma. Upanayika is it leading onward to nibbana, to non-attachment, to freedom, to liberation from birth and death. When you open to truth, and it takes you to deathlessness, to ammata dhamma, to immortal truth. And bhajitang is it can only be realized each one for themselves. I can't do it for you. You have to do it yourself. It's like eating food, isn't it? My eating food, it's bhajitang. I have to do it myself. You say, oh, Venerable Tomato, I'll eat for you. So you eat. Day after day, I sit here starving to death. The same with spiritual life. It's it has to. We have to do it. We have to turn to it. We have to open to Dhamma ourselves. There's not a priest or a sacrificial victim or anyone that can do it for us. No, sometimes we'd like someone else to do it. Would you do it for me? In Thailand, oftentimes that's the case. They say, why don't you? They're quite willing to be generous and giving to the Sangha, to the monks. They say, why don't you do it? But it's bhajitang. It has each one this openness, this opening to truth. Each one must do it for themselves. So Dhamma, Buddha, Dhamma. Dhamma cannot be personified. You never find Dhamma rupas. You don't have, there's no form for Dhamma. They symbolize it sometimes as a wheel, Dhamma jaka. Because of our liking of symbols. But it's never personified. You never find a Dhamma Rupa in a kind of personal form at all. There's Buddha Rupas, but not Dhamma as a being, as a man or a woman. So Dhamma is truth. So it's beyond. It embraces all of it, all the forms, so that you can't choose any form for it. There's the dhammas. This word is used both for the conditions of the good, the bad, the high, the low, the coarse, the subtle, skillful, unskillful dhammas. And then there's the amata dhamma, the deathless. So it's a word that includes everything because it supports everything. Everything is dhamma, in other words. It's something that is that we're never separate from. If we turn to it, then we abide in that which is supporting rather than that which is arising and ceasing. And so the enlightened state of a human being is when they when they realize that, when you abide in Dhamma, in that which is all and everything, all-pervading, supporting everything, rather than in the attachment to the changing conditions of body and mind. Because that is suffering. When you're attached and dependent upon the changing conditions, and that is the dukkha of existence. When you let go of that, then that is the enlightenment, the liberation from dukkha, from ignorance. Then the sangha, the third refuge, is the supatipanno, ujjupatipanno, yayapatipanno, sammijjipatipanno. These are, these were the practicers, the one who actually are practicing the Dhamma. Sangha, the word sangha has this meaning of a group. It's not personal anymore. It's not sumeto bhikkhu, amaro bhikkhu, sister Karuna. It's not a personality. It's a community of people practicing, taking refuge in Buddha and Dhamma. So in Sangha, we give up our kind of individual demands on life and identities more and more because of the refuges in those who practice the Dhamma, rather than in personal gifts, personal abilities, personal qualities. And the worldly life is very much refuge in personality, isn't it? Where we, if you want to be successful in worldly values, you have to emphasize your personality, your talents, your special abilities, yourself as an individual. You have to compete and make it in the world to get ahead, to attain and achieve, to prove yourself as a person, as an individual. But in Sangha, say that we give up, all that movement towards establishing ourselves as an individual personality toward the common ground of supatipanno, one who's practicing in the right way, doing good, practicing Dhamma. Ujjupatipanno, which is direct. This is very direct teaching. It's not roundabout. Not abstracted in any way. It's not muddled or unclear. It's very direct. It's proper. It always in a sense of propriety and sincerity, all these beautiful qualities of a human being where we're doing what is right, what is proper, what is sincere, rather than just what is expedient in the moment. So Sangha is the actual human being that is no longer seeking to affirm their position as an individual, but as a supatipanno, an ujjupatipanno, blending in with a group, with the virtuous ones, the ones who practice the Dhamma, who are those who are inclining to Nibbana. This is the morning's reflection on Buddha Dhamma Sangha. I'm trying to encourage you to contemplate and reflect on the use of a shrine, use of Theravada and Buddhist custom, of the symbolism of Buddhism, not to convert you to Buddhism or make you believe in it, but this is an example of how to use the symbols and the conventions for reflection, for opening the mind, helping you to give using the conventional world that we have around us so that it helps you, frees you from ignorance rather than keeping you ignorant. So now if you just stretch your legs, we can sit quietly.